can we make you a personalized podcast playlist?
Head on over to thehostquiz.com, answer 7 easy questions, and get a unique to your hosting biz playlist of thanks for visiting podcast episodes to help you smash your goals.
The action plan and strategies that will elevate your business is one quick quiz and a set of headphones away. Again, head to thehostquiz.com and take our quick hosting quiz today.
You're listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. We believe hosting with heart is at the core of every short-term rental. With Annette's background in business operation
and Sarah's extensive hospitality management and interior design experience, we have welcomed thousands of guests from over 30 countries, earning us over $1 million and garnering us thousands of five-star reviews.
We love sharing creative ways for your listing to stand out, serve your guests, and be profitable. Each episode, we will have knowledgeable guests who bring value to the short-term rental industry.
Or we will share our stories of our own experiences so you can implement actual improvements to your rentals. Whether you're experienced, new, or nervous to start your own short-term rental, we promise you'll feel right at home. Before we dive into the content, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Want to stop giving away money in Airbnb and Vrbo fees and actually own your guest relationships?
You don't need to be a tech wizard to make it happen. We use StayFi, and it's been a total game changer for our direct booking strategy.
Every time a guest connects to the Wi-Fi, StayFi captures their name, email, and phone number automatically. No awkward asks, no spreadsheets, just verified data you can actually use.
And here's what's wild. We send just one email a month to our email list, and we always get 2 to 3 direct bookings from it. And that's barely scratching the surface. Imagine what a weekly newsletter could do.
Some StayFi users have boosted their direct bookings by over 35% and increased their occupancy by up to 20% just by using the tools inside of StayFi.
StayFi's new plug-and-play hardware makes setup ridiculously easy, and the branded splash page gives your guests a hotel-level experience.
So, if you want to start marketing like a pro and build a real guest list, not Airbnbs, this is how you do it.
Head to stayfi.com/TFV to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's stayfi.com/TFV.
Hello, welcome back to another great episode. My name is Sarah Karakayan.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are...
Thanks for visiting. Let's start this episode like we do each and every week, and that is celebrating one of you, our incredible listeners, who are heading on over to strshare.com, sharing everything about your short-term rental so we can share you here on the podcast and on our Instagram account. If I said channel, she would elbow me right now. Every Sunday. Annette, who are we sharing this week?
This week we are sharing at the Laurel Loft in San Diego. And it is absolutely beautiful. I'm just going to share. I have not seen an aesthetic feed like theirs.
What do you mean by that?
Remember back in the good old early days of Instagram, like there was a cohesiveness of...
Like the color and vibe.
And like all of the tiles would actually like tell a story and be together before the kind of TikTok reel, you know, face to camera took over. And so it took me back, but I love it. And I was like, oh, this is really great. But they do have reels. They just make sure their cover on everything is in the design aesthetic of their home. And so I really appreciate it.
You know what that tells me about their hosting style?
What?
They care about the details.
They do care about the details. One thing I want to pull out that I think is a great idea that I'm going to offer to all of you hosts to copy off the Laurel Loft. I hope they don't mind. They do this really cool reel every year. And it's a year in reviews, and they go through and screenshot and share all of the reviews. And what I love about it as a consumer is they do it each and every year. So again, they building that trust that they are going to get these 5-star reviews. They got them in 2024. They got them in 2023. They got them in 22. So it really just shows that history. And hosts, this is that thing where when you can start to have content that is consistent and you're like, oh, I made that reel last year. Actually, Sarah and I do this on our podcast. We do a year in review of all the highest rated podcasts. So that's just something that we can lean on every year that we do. So go to their Instagram, check it out. And then last but not least, the one thing that I want to share with you is, again, right there on their bio, they have purchased their .com, theLaurelLoft.com. You can go directly to it and book direct. So well done, The Laurel Loft. We want to plan a trip now to San Diego. But before we do that, Sarah, let's get serious.
Right. We have to talk to Darren Nix, who is the founder and CEO of Steadily, one of the fastest growing landlord insurance companies in the U.S. And his journey into insurtech, which I didn't know that was a word, but now I do, started with a personal loss of his own. As a real estate investor himself, he had a rental property, and you're going to learn about this story in entirety, but it burned down. And he was shocked by how confusing and slow the insurance process was to get back up and running. That experience sparked a mission to build a modern landlord insurance company that worked for and is built around the real estate investor, which I've always been taught that. If you want a great CPA, find a CPA who invests in real estate themselves. So how cool would it be to work with an insurance company whose CEO and founder is a real estate investor himself, who has experienced the not so fun side of working with an insurance company who doesn't feel like they're a partner with you along the way. So this episode is chock full of tips and tricks on how to make sure that your insurance policy not only has adequate coverage for you, but also how you can maximize the ROI of your rental as a landlord. Because you have to remember, Darren is an investor himself. He wants cash flow too, just like you all do. So he threw me for a loop with a couple of his tips, especially being the CEO of an insurance company. Darren, there's nothing like welcoming you to the TFE podcast than by asking you about this tragic loss you experienced that catapulted this next journey in your life. Can you share what happened that inspired Steadily?
I made so many mistakes as a property investor. That's probably the third one that I made, but certainly the most expensive. So it was a property in South Carolina, second one that I had owned. I was 2 years into being a property investor, and I got a call from my property manager, which was unusual. They never call me. And I screened the call the first time because it's in a meeting, and then the phone immediately rang again like a minute later. And I was like, okay, I probably need to take this. So I pick up the phone and she says, hey, I have some bad news. Your property burned down. And I'm like, what? You know, like when you get that kind of news, it takes a minute for your brain to catch up to that surprise. So I'm kind of speechless for 15 seconds or so. And she's like, yeah, so they think there was a space heater or something and the fire trucks are out and it's on the news. And so I pull up the local TV station because this property is 1500 miles away. I'm living in Texas and property is in South Carolina. And yeah, one of the tenants had gone for work and a space heater had knocked over, and it was a triplex, the middle unit in a triplex, and it basically burned it to the ground. But it's kind of a testament to the quality of the construction that the units on either side were actually okay. And 11 months later, $250,000 in repairs, plus some, you know, loss of rent and paying for my tenant's hotel bill and everything. That was my journey into the wonderful world of huge insurance claims or rental properties. This is well before I started selling, by the way. This was just one of the many things that set me on that path.
And your experience was dealing with the insurance company was tough and it took a long time. And it seemed like maybe you were confused about the process and you were just unimpressed.
Incredibly confused. And about 11 months beginning to end, I kept getting these, I guess it was more of, I didn't even know where to start because this property burns down. I call the insurance company, I say the property burned down, and they're like, okay, thanks for letting us know. Like, do you have has work started? on repairing it. And I'm like, am I supposed to go and find a contractor? And then I send you the bill? Like, how does this work? And so the long and short of it was, yes, I went knocking on doors remotely because, again, it's out of state. Talked to a bunch of people. Finally found some contractors that were willing to go out and do an estimate. A few weeks go by. They emailed me this 35-page long PDF that lists the number of screws that they'll need to repair the property and everything. I later learned that's called an exactimate estimate. And they sent that to me. I sent that to the insurance company, and they were like, okay. So I just picked this guy sight unseen. He starts working on the property, and a long time later, the property got repaired. But I realized along the way that I had ended up paying about $30,000 out of pocket above and beyond what the insurance paid for because of some mistakes I made along the way of organizing it. And I think that the main takeaways that I had was just, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I sort of expected that the folks who deal with fires and insurance claims day in and day out would sort of step in and say, okay, we got this. This is what we do. We'll let you know when it's done. Because that's what had happened when my car had gotten damaged, you know, 5 or 6 years earlier. I'd been in a car crash. I reported the claim and they said, take it here. Do these things. You'll get the car back in 3 weeks. Here's a loaner. It was kind of like painless, but getting a rental property repaired from 1,500 miles away was the complete antithesis of that. It was bad.
Was this your last rental property or did you continue to invest?
I'm a glutton for punishment. So I kept buying more. South Carolina was one of the many mistakes that I made as a rental property investor, not because there's anything wrong with that market, but because it was the one part of the country that I had never lived in. So previous to that, I bought my first property was in Chicago, in a neighborhood where I used to live, Indianapolis, where I grew up, and Texas, Kansas City. These were all markets in places where I had family. I'd spent a bunch of time, so I knew the markets. South Carolina was one that I picked by looking at the rent to buy ratios and being really quantitative about it in spreadsheets. And it's not a coincidence that that one went badly.
Interesting. I like that you mentioned that because in the short term rental space, so many people just want the best buy. And there's so many, Sarah and I chat often about how the spreadsheet doesn't tell the whole story. There's a lot of other reasons to purchase a property besides, you know, reviewing the spreadsheet and what the math would tell you, because there's a lot involved. Like you just said, there's emotions a part of it too. We want to talk about, let's talk about risk. That's what we're chatting about here. We talked to so many hosts, and the first thing everybody still to this day, whether they're a new host, a seasoned host, they still want to talk about the guest and the guest damaging a property or the guest having a party. But we know, you know, from data, that isn't what most insurance claims are on short-term rentals. Can you kind of debunk those myths and like what are actually the things that people are claiming in their short-term rentals the most, just to kind of reinforce that for ourselves and our listeners?
The single biggest loss is fire. Fires don't happen all that often, but when they do, it's going to be $100,000. And in fact, the average amount of a fire claim is $95,000, sometimes much more. The second biggest loss is going to be wind. So that's when hail or a tree blows over and falls on your roof. Hail is going to be a $15,000 claim because that's what it costs to build the average new roof. If a tree blows over, now it's $50,000 because you're not just repairing the roof. Now you have to pay to get the tree cut down, hauled off of the crane, get the wall repaired, repainted, etc. And then the last one is water. So a pipe burst, hopefully it bursts on the ground floor, so it just floods, you know, the main floor and the basement. If it bursts on the second floor, now you're talking about replacing a lot of drywall, mold, etc. That's typically a $30,000 claim. And so from my perspective, at my peak, I owned 15 doors, and some of those were short-term and mid-term rentals. The tenant damage is really annoying when it happens, don't get me wrong, but it's not the source of the really big insurance claims, like the really catastrophic stuff. those things are the ones that happen a lot more rarely, but when they do happen, they're severe. So in insurance world, we'd call that low frequency, high severity.
And okay, if a host is a new, you know, they're just getting into short-term rentals, they finally understand that they need a certain kind of insurance to cover short-term rentals, which we'll backtrack to that in a moment here. But how can Annette and I, with you here today, better prepare our listeners to ask the right questions? How do you know if you've never experienced catastrophic loss like this with your rental, or it's your first rental, or how do they know that they are adequately covered? They're going to get great guidance. What do you say? How do we educate them?
Two ways. Number one, my favorite, is to find a community of folks that have done this already for several years and to pick their brain. That's number one. Number two is to interview your insurance agent or your insurance company and find somebody who's done 100 rentals before and has seen a bunch of claims already go through, so they can speak in an educated way about what happens. Because an insurance form is on average 45 to 70 pages long. And you want to talk to somebody who knows what's in it from memory, not having to go and read it to try to figure out what's in it to see if a particular situation is covered.
Can we put our policy, do you trust putting it through ChatGPT and asking it to help us find, like, educate us on it or find any flaws in it?
Trust is a strong word.
Okay.
What I do with ChatGPT is I don't trust its answer, but I trust it to tell me where the answer is.
Okay.
So what I would say is, here's my policy document. Tell me the place in the document. Show me the exact paragraph that explains if I'm covered for X. And then it will say, okay, your stamp collection is covered for $2,500. And then it shows you the actual text of what's in the policy. That I love, because now you've removed the risk of hallucination. Because what's happened to me a million times when I just said, hey, does my policy cover X? Or, you know, when I'm working on, like, so let's say a pilot's license, I say, is blah, blah, blah legal? And it gives me an answer. It's so confident, but it's just wrong. It just hallucinated the answer. And so if you instead you ask it for, show me the source of where this answer is, now you can easily, with one extra click, verify that it's accurate.
So I like this. So today, people could take their current policies, and we just went over fire, wind, hail, tree, water. They could put their policy in and ask specific questions, like, take me directly to fire coverage, pull that out. It sounds like we could do that to, at least after this episode, go in and really dig deeper into these top areas that you said, let's review those, and they could look at those. I like that as a something that's digestible, easy, and they could educate themselves and kind of see if there's some maybe holes in their policy or not ahead of time. I'm here for that. That's something quick, and I think pull it so you're not overwhelmed by the 45 to 70 pages. They can kind of dive directly in.
Easy.
No, that's great.
When it comes to the agent, though, and making sure they've seen a lot, is it just asking them how many policies? If someone's interviewing a new insurance agent, or someone's listening to this episode and they're interested in suddenly, how do we qualify the person we're talking to has our best interest in mind? Because I think Annette and I feel this, not just obviously in the insurance industry, but in a lot of different areas of our life. We feel like we're kind of in a trust recession right now, and everyone is kind of doubting everyone's intentions. So since you're on the other side, what are some great questions that a host could ask an agent to kind of qualify them as someone they can trust?
Number one is, how many insurance policies on a rental property do you write in a typical month?
What's
you would
answer?
Like to hear something like 20
okay.
or more.
Okay.
That indicates that they're a specialist.
Correct.
Number two is to ask, when you compare the types of losses that occur on a rental property versus a homeowner's policy, how are they different? That's also going to tell you if they're keyed into those distinctions. And in particular, if they follow up and say, well, are you a midterm host on Furnish Finder? Are you an Airbnb or Vrbo? Are you doing long-term rentals? If they ask those kind of nuanced questions,
yeah,
great. Now you're talking to someone that's been around the block several times and they're going to know the ins and outs. The trust piece is another great dimension. And that's where you can sort of ask some leading questions that somebody who just wants to sell you as much insurance as possible would go down and be like, oh yeah, you're going to need a $5 million umbrella policy and you're probably going to need $2 million in liability, blah, 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 blah. And if you know going in that, hey, I just own one rental property and my net worth in my household is, you know, $650,000 with my 401k, you probably don't need a $5 million umbrella policy. Like, you just don't have the kind of assets that are going to make a plaintiff's attorney want to come after you in a liability lawsuit. And so if somebody's trying to sell you all of those odds and ends coverages, they may not have your best interest at heart.
You mentioned midterm rental in that last segment. What are the differences, or what should we be on the lookout for if we are doing, we do a hybrid strategy at one of our properties, going from short term to midterm, like toggling between those two? Is there anything specific hosts doing that strategy need to be aware of?
Vacancy duration. It is such a gotcha in insurance because there's this misconception that the tenants are what caused the damage in a property. It's not. Vacancies are what damage the property, because if a water starts dripping in the attic from a roof leak and you've had a vacancy for 3 weeks, by the time somebody comes in and notices, that's going to be a $40,000 repair. But if somebody had noticed it on day one, it would be a $3,000 repair.
Right.
And so that type of experience over the course of hundreds of years of insurance companies gathering data on how losses happen turns into a 30-day limit on vacancy for most insurance policies. And so if somebody has a typical insurance policy and they put the house on the market and all the tenants move out because they're planning to sell it, ask me how I know. And 50 days go by and then somebody breaks into the property and does a bunch of damage to it, the property has now been vacant for more than 30 days. Your insurance policy will not pay for damage because it's been vacant for more than 30 days. And they're like, no, we priced it assuming that there were people living in the property who would find these types of issues. Think about vandalism. If you have somebody living in the property, the odds that somebody's going to break in and graffiti the walls are pretty low. But if you've got a for rent sign that's been outside of the building for 45 days and anybody walking by can see that there are no lights on, your odds of getting a vandalism claim go up like 500%.
This vacancy duration, that's new to me. I've not ever...
Right. So is there some sort of clause that we can get so that doesn't apply if we're midterm rental hosts, or how does that work?
You just, when you're going to have a long-term vacancy, you call up your insurance company and you say, hey, my property is going to be vacant for more than 30 days. Add on coverage for long-term vacancy. And it's not that expensive, but they have to know about it ahead of time.
Interesting. So what about an accidental long-term vacancy? Let's say a host just, they went to midterm, they're trying to get it rented out, or they went to short-term and for some reason they haven't gotten any bookings, you know, they kind of have not been paying attention to their listing for 45 days. What happens if it was accidental and they just were sitting open like that? Is that where the insurance company would still like focus them back on that vacancy duration? Like, there is no such thing as accidental. They need to have awareness of that.
Yeah, the policy doesn't speak to intent. It just says, Oh, the property was vacant for a long time. And especially if the vacancy was what they would call a proximate cause. So I'll give you an example. If the property has been vacant for 45 days and a storm blows through and rips the roof off, the roof would have gotten ripped off whether the property was vacant or not. So the policy is still going to pay for that. But fire, vandalism, water damage, those are things that probably would not have happened if the property is occupied. And so then the policy is going to say, this shouldn't have happened because we agreed that we were insuring an occupied property. So where this is going is there's a lot of gotchas. No one can be expected to know all of these gotchas. Mm-hmm. And so the best advice that I can give that I wish I had followed myself is, call your agent when something changes. You don't need to stay on top of it when things are in a steady state. If you've been renting it for 4 years, tenants are coming and going, no need to check in with your agent. But if something changes, send them an email and be like, hey, this thing is happening. I just want to make sure I'm covered. You decide to upgrade your listing to try to be able to get a much higher nightly rate. So you buy $100,000 of high-end furniture and you move it all in. Well, guess what? Your policy probably only covers you for 10% of the face value of your policy. So let's be more specific. Let's say that you have a $250,000 policy. That means that by default, you're only going to have $25,000 worth of coverage for furnishings. So if you just moved in a ton of high-end stuff, you need to email your agent and say, hey, I'm bringing in like leather sofas and a $10,000 stereo system or a hot tub or whatever it is. I want to make sure this is going to be covered. And they'll check your limits and be like, okay, I just bumped it up to like whatever. And probably it'll add like $14 or $15 to your annual bill. But you'll know that you're actually covered because you sent that note.
You just mentioned it briefly. You said hot tub, but what are exposures? So many people now are doing saunas, cold plunge, pickleball court. What exposure is there? Is that also when you're adding amenities, whatever that amenity might be, is that a call ahead of time to review also? Like, do you find that a lot of times that hosts are implementing amenities and then calling to see if they're insured on them?
Yes, but the good news is that for most amenities, getting them insured is not going to change the bill all that dramatically, as long as the company doing the insuring knows ahead of time or is told ahead of a claim. Okay. So you don't want to wait until the claim happens to let them know that you made all these upgrades. But when you're talking about risks, the way as a host you can boil this down to where there's risk is asking yourself, what's the probability that a six-year-old is going to get badly hurt in my property? So a pickleball court, shrug, a hot tub, potential concerning, a trampoline with no netting around it, extremely high concern, pool with no locking fence, pretty high concern. So these are the types of things that insurance companies worry about and figure into the, you know, the cost of the insurance, because what they're looking at is what are the odds that I'm going to end up paying $1 million liability claim because something really bad happened. That's what they're trying to do the math on.
Okay. So is that a common thing that hosts should think about? Like, honestly, is this the six-year-old, like who is the guest that's going to be using the property? Is that kind of can our host start doing the six-year-old test of like just thinking through all of them? And is it like, do you think of the older adult? Do you think of the middle-aged adult and then a child when you're kind of processing what you're thinking about adding to your home?
I would advise hosts to make the investments in the property regardless of the insurance landscape that they think is going to deliver the best return on the property. So the property needs a trampoline or it needs a pool, do it. But when you're trying to anticipate how the insurance company is going to react, and what's probably going to happen to the premium, you can predict how they're going to react by imagining what bad thing is going to happen to a six-year-old when they encounter that thing.
I know that a lot of hosts think that they're protecting themselves, Darren, by an additional waiver. So they'll have a pool waiver. They'll have a hot tub waiver. They'll whatever amenity they have. How do those actually protect the host? Or does the insurance company need to have reviewed that waiver ahead of time? Because I do feel like we talk to a lot of hosts that require all these waivers to be signed, and I don't know if they're actually going to protect them if something were to happen.
They're not actually going to protect them in the way that they wish they would. They're better than nothing.
Okay.
And the insurance company does not want to review them because it would cost them $500 to have an attorney pick up the phone and take a look at that contract. So it's better than nothing. But the problem with these types of contracts is that when you think about lawsuits, number one, in the United States in particular, nobody has to expect to win a lawsuit in order to file one. And just defending a lawsuit is often a $100,000 endeavor, even if you know you're going to win. It's still going to cost you $100,000. Number two is that in many cases, you're not trying to convince a judge. You're trying to convince a jury. And juries are weird. And so as a host, sure, have people sign the waiver, but buy insurance anyway.
Right. Is
my take, because that piece of paper very, very likely will not hold up when something bad happens.
Yeah. And now that we've talked about all these, I won't say scary, although I want to, all of these realistic potential events, let's go back to the fact that, Darren, there are still hosts out there, experienced hosts, who don't have the proper coverage. Either they have homeowners insurance or a landlord policy, and they sign up and they list their property on Airbnb, and Airbnb touts air cover, and they don't think twice about it. How would you explain to these hosts who still don't understand or haven't really thought about it in a way that until it's too late, that they may be inadequately covered and that air cover isn't the best insurance policy for them or one at all?
I want to answer this in two ways. One is just to give the crisp explanation of what air cover does and doesn't cover. And then two, to talk about what is too much insurance and when you might consider buying less insurance. Mm-hmm. So air cover, you can think of it as simply from the time that the check-in starts to the checkout time, air cover will pay for damage that the tenant does to your property. So if a tenant comes in and pours beer all over your couch and you have to get that replaced, and they did it during the time of their stay, air cover will pay for that. If a tornado comes through and blows the roof off your property while a tenant is staying there, air cover will not pay for it, because the tenant didn't do it. Nature did it. And they're expecting that your homeowner's policy or your landlord policy will pay for that. And so air cover is always intended to be paired with a landlord insurance policy, because the landlord insurance policy covers the brick and mortar, and it covers all of the things that happen to the property that happen when the guest is not in the property, or things that the guest didn't do. So air cover is actually quite limited. And typically your air cover claims are going to be like $500, $1,000, like a broken window, like a messed up couch, stuff like that. The landlord insurance policy is typically $20,000 claims, $50,000, $100,000, like much lower frequency, much, much higher severity.
And if we're doing short-term stays, is a landlord policy adequate for that?
A landlord policy works just fine, and 20% of the business that we write is on Airbnbs out of the like 100,000 policies that we write per year. But the other thing that I want to mention, part two of this, is what's too much insurance? So as a landlord, you have a choice that you can make. You can use insurance to insulate you from catastrophic events and accept that you're going to have to pay out of pocket for the bumps along the way. And by bumps, I mean anything under $3,000. Or you can try to use insurance to make your ride completely smooth, so you're never paying out of pocket for anything that happens. You can do it the second way, but it's going to lower your annual return a lot, because that type of insurance is really expensive. And here's why. The insurance industry, on average, runs about a 5 to 6% profit margin. It's like it's a very low margin business. And so if you pay in a year $1,000 in premium, the insurance company at the end of the day is going to make a profit of about $50 to $70 on that $1,000. And the rest of that is going to be paid out in claims and overhead of running the insurance company. But the simple act of buying, paying $1,000 for coverage when you know that the insurance company is going to make a profit and has their own overhead, means that for every dollar that you're paying in coverage, you're probably going to get less than $1,000 back in claims payments. And so by definition, insurance is an expensive thing to buy. So you want to buy just the right amount of it and not buy too much. And if you're using insurance to try to pay for $500 broken windows and $1,000 couches to like smooth out your investment returns, you are paying a ton of money to someone else to reduce that volatility. And generally speaking, my advice to my friends who own Airbnbs is, instead of buying a super expensive insurance policy that's going to pay for a broken window, take the money you would have spent on that Cadillac insurance plan and put it into a separate bank account that's your self-insurance bank account. And then when those broken windows happen, pay it out of your own insurance fund. And at the end of the day, you'll save money doing it that way. So, this is the insurance guy telling you to buy less insurance.
Yeah, I like this take on it. So, and are you saying then that when they are on the phone and you've given them these great questions to ask the insurance agent, to tell them they'd like to focus on fire, wind, and hail?
And water damage.
That was what I want. Water damage. Is that the focus? And then this everything else is pretty much considered potentially smaller? Or are there claims that happen and they're kind of in that mid area that we want to make sure that we have good coverage for too?
All of this gets boiled down into the deductible. So if you go to an insurance company and you say, I want to buy a policy that's a $500 deductible on it or a $250 deductible, what the insurance company hears is, this is a person that's going to file a lot of claims, because every time anything happens, no matter how small, there's going to be a claim for it. Whereas if somebody comes along and says, I want to buy a policy with a $2,500 deductible or even a $5,000 or a $10,000 deductible, what they now hear is, the only time this person is going to call me is when a tree falls on the roof or something really bad happens. And so the difference in price for an insurance policy with a $500 versus a $5,000 deductible is going to be enormous. And so for investors that have a few thousand dollars that they can squirrel away in a rainy day fund and self-insure a little bit, are ultimately going to make higher profits on their rental because they're not spending as much money on insurance.
Is there a time when you had mentioned earlier that when there's a change, that's definitely when you should reach out? Is there a time when, let's say you brought in an additional amenity or something's going on in the area and you're really seeing a significant spike in your revenue from years prior? Is there a revenue change that would ever trigger an insurance upgrade at all?
Not from a property insurance perspective, but as someone's net worth starts to increase, you start to worry about how juicy of a target are you going to be for a plaintiff's attorney, somebody who just sees a big pile of money with stuff to take. And so that's when people start to get into having 2-3 properties, a lot of net worth that they've built up over the years, that's when they start asking questions about umbrella policies, because the umbrella policy is what kicks in with really high liability limits above and beyond what a landlord policy would cover. So let's use specific numbers. Let's say somebody buys a landlord insurance policy on a $300,000 rental, and it has $1 million of liability coverage. What they're starting to think about now is, oh, but I own a bunch of rental properties and my net worth is $3.5 million. And if somebody, the odds are low, but if something really bad happens and there's somebody dies on one of my properties and they name me in a wrongful death suit because I, you know, failed to have the parking lot iced with salt after the snowstorm or something like that, and they hold me liable, well, they can come after all of my assets as the owner. And so then they start thinking about buying an umbrella policy to raise those limits to $3 million or $5 million, so that they're having protection for those like long tail, super catastrophic outcomes. And that's generally the more you see someone's net worth go up, the more likely it is that they're going to be buying a high limit umbrella policy.
I like that. That's the key. I think also Sarah and I talk to hosts every day, and they are, maybe they start with one property and then they end up with a full portfolio, which their guests can go online and pull up their direct booking website and see that, you know, Susan owns 7 properties, and they can kind of get an idea of what her and her family is working with at that point in time. And so the umbrella policy, is that something that the landlord policy, could they help us with that, or should we go to a different insurer for that?
Almost across the board, whatever insurance agent that you end up working with, if they do landlord insurance, they're also going to have landlord. If they do landlord insurance, they're also going to have umbrella policies.
Great. No, that's a great, I like that it's, so to recap there, it's not necessarily the revenue on the individual property. It's your overall net worth that should trigger that umbrella policy.
That's the way that I think about it. Because just because your revenue went up on a property doesn't mean that the risk on that property changed at all. One, when we're talking about various gotchas, the one that does come to mind as revenue starts to increase is, let's say that somebody bought a property in 2019, and they insured it for $250,000. And they've been happily plunking down their insurance premiums every year, and now it's 2025. What do you think that house is worth now? A lot more. So maybe that house now is a $500,000 house or a $600,000 house, especially if it's in a vacation town. And so the house now is ridiculously underinsured. And so if the house got totaled in like a fire scenario, and the insurance company is going to look at the policy and say, well, you bought $250,000 worth of coverage, so here's your $250,000. And the owner is saying, yeah, but it's going to cost me $500,000 now to rebuild the property, because over time, the insured value of the property got out of sync with the cost to replace. So this isn't a thing that people need to think about every year, but as people are doing those, every 5-year look backs, asking, hey, do I actually have enough insurance to rebuild this property if it burned to the ground? That's really the question.
So this is a moment. If you have been listening to our show since 2019 and you haven't increased the coverage on it, or you haven't looked at, you know, what your home currently is worth, or you've been touting to everybody how much equity you've gained in that home, but your insurance premiums haven't changed, you probably need to check yourself, call your agent, make sure you're in alignment still.
And what
that.
Do you do, Darren? Do you suggest that they get the home reappraised? Is it really just what Zillow says? How can a homeowner
Most of our hosts have purchased pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And I think they have a decent amount of equity growth since then. So what should their move be?
The good news is this one's really simple. The insurance companies all run a replacement cost estimator. So you just give them the address and say, hey, I want to know what your estimate is to rebuild this property if it burns down. And they'll come back and they say, we think it's 300K. And you're like, great, then I need 300K of coverage. Because it's not the market value of the house that matters. It's what it costs to rebuild it.
Okay.
So let's say that you own I've seen these houses in San Francisco. You can buy a literal shack for $700,000 because the land is worth $698,000 with a $2,000 shack on top of it. And so the replacement cost for the shack is $2,000. And so when you're thinking about how much insurance to buy, it's not what it says on Zillow that matters. What matters is the cost to rebuild the property. And generally speaking, if you just take the square footage and you multiply that by 200, that's going to get you into the ballpark. In some places, we'll see that go down to like 150. And in really high-end markets, that might go up to like 450 or 500 per square foot.
And you said that, are the insurance companies running that yearly when we are looking at the renewal? Is that automatically?
If they're on top of their game, yes. If
okay.
they're not, no.
Okay. So that's another pro tip though, if they're not doing that automatic, what did you exactly call it again?
Replacement cost estimate.
Replacement cost estimate at your renewal, then they should, you might want to nudge them or look elsewhere. Okay, replacement.
Every few years, do that. You can do this as a thought experiment. Think about the last time you had work done on anything in the house, like a new bathroom, a new kitchen, whatever, and just say, how much did I end up paying per square foot? And then extrapolate that to the rest of your house. And that's kind of going to give you an understanding of, you really can't get anything done in most cities for less than $200 a square foot.
Yeah. All right, Darren. Hosts have a lot of options. Why Steadily? What makes Steadily different? And I'm wondering if one of those differences is when something catastrophic happens, there's a partner on the other end to help them know what that first step is when something happens and panic sets in and the host just feels overwhelmed? Or what is it?
The reason everybody should choose Steadily out of the many options they have is because landlord insurance is all we do. We are landlords. And when a claim happens, we are the claims adjusters. So from the time that you call us to ask questions about your rental property for the year, so you're insured with us, all the way up to the moment when we rebuild the property for you, you're with us the entire way. So we know nothing better than landlord insurance and rental properties because it's literally our only product. And we, at this point, have 110,000 customers across the country that we've been able to help, and they're all landlords.
And this is U.S. only, correct? Just for our international listeners. I'm going to make sure.
This is U.S. only today. Call me again in a few years.
Okay. I like it, Darren.
I love that. Yes. And so what if someone listening is working with a broker? Could they say that they want to hear more about Steadily, or they have to call Steadily directly?
Both ways. So a huge chunk of our customers come direct. Those that want to work with an agent, we have at this point more than 15,000 agents across the country that sell Steadily policies. And so both ways work just fine.
Interesting. And then as we wrap up, what is an insider tip, something that you think every short-term rental host should know, whether it's about insurance, risk, anything? What's one thing that you feel is under, where hosts are underserved?
You got me on this one. You're going to have to edit this one, I think.
It's okay.
I already used the one about calling your agent when something changes.
That's okay. Let's just reiterate that, because I think sometimes what could be, when it is something that changes, let's pause on that. What is something that we wouldn't think is an important change that an agent would be like, oh my gosh, why didn't you tell us that? That you see all the time of like, we didn't think it was that big of a deal, but it's like so obvious to the insurance company.
Great. The thing I would ask folks to do is to fire off an email to their agent, describe the property and what's going on with it, and just say, am I covered? Because it takes 60 seconds to fire off that email, and you might be surprised. So as an example, there are a bunch of people out there that have this type of coverage called actual cash value, not replacement cost, and they don't know it. And in the scenario where something bad happens, they're probably going to get paid about a tenth of what they think they're going to get paid by their insurance policy. They don't know it. And all they would have to do to figure this out is to email their agent and say, hey, I'm planning to buy this property and Airbnb it. If the property burns down, will I get paid full replacement cost for the property? My property is about to be vacant for 45 days. If something happens on day 45, am I covered? You don't have to think of all the gotchas that might be out there. Just describe the state of the property, describe the state of the world, and say, am I covered? I do this myself. I own an insurance company, and I bought an insurance policy for another type of product that's not landlord insurance. And I emailed my agent 3 weeks ago, and I said, am I going to be covered in this scenario? And he wrote back and he's like, I checked the policy and you're good. And that was how I slept well at night. Because like I said, the policy is 48 pages long. Even if I did read the whole thing, I'm not going to be confident that I understood it. But that's the agent's job. And it can give tremendous a peace of mind to just fire off that email with a few bullet points and say, is this going to do what I think it's going to do?
I think that's actually the pro tip right there, Darren, is that you own an insurance company and you still have doubts. And you know that when in doubt, reach out to your agent and get that confirmation. Because I also feel like sometimes people don't reach out. It's like, oh, is that a silly question? Or I don't want to bother them. It's like, no, absolutely. Well, ask those questions.
And it's very different than emailing your CPA or attorney and you get charged by the minute, where like you can email your insurance broker and
Good point. We're scared, you know, not scared, but you're like, ah, is that question worth getting billable hours?
I blow up my CPA and attorney because I'd rather know, but that's my personality. But it is nice to know that you can just email just ask.
So by the way, for those listening, thanks for visiting. I'm in charge of the CPA and attorney, so I am diligent on the questions that I ask.
Yeah, and there's properties that I don't own with you, and I am asking them questions all the time. Darren,
so
if someone has a policy in place and they think it's fine, we'll steadily look at it and compare to what you guys could offer and give them an answer, honest feedback on it.
We do it all the time. And most insurance companies out there are great. So I'm not here to tell everybody that they should come switch to Steadily. But if for some reason they're unhappy or they're struggling to get coverage, please come to Steadily.com and we'd love to give you a quote.
Awesome.
Great. So is that the best place to find out more about Steadily? Go to Steadily.com. We'll put links in the show notes too. But anything else we should know about Steadily before we sign off, Darren?
Landlord insurance is all we do, and we would love to help.
Ah, great.
I love this.
Thank
this is a
you
great
for your time.
Open
yeah.
conversation, honest conversation, Darren. Thank you so much for helping all those hosts out there. With that, I am Sarah Karakane.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are.
Thanks for visiting.
Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. Head on over to the show notes for additional information about today's episode. And please hit that subscribe button and leave us a review. Awesome reviews help us bring you awesome content. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to hanging out with you next week.
Want to know our best-kept hosting secrets?
They're all inside our STR Must-Haves Master List, our secret weapon that continues to transform ordinary host into extraordinary host.
The Must-Haves Master List is a checklist that we've been perfecting for over 12 years.
Picture this: your guest checks in to your short-term rental and they're instantly wowed by the thoughtful touches and impeccable amenities. Why? Because you've got the TFE Must-Haves Master List by your side.
This checklist has all the insider secrets that even the best host didn't know they were missing.
We challenge you to take the checklist into your property today. See how many items you can mark off of this list. You didn't get them all? No worries. This is your chance to level up. So go to hostchecklist.com and grab your free copy. That's hostchecklist.com to download our coveted checklist today.